had his sister's back. Sir Adam snorted disdainfully.
He would have to be an utter ass to trade Jaime Lannister's life for two girls.
Then we must ransom Sir Jaime, whatever it costs, Lord Lyford said.
Tyrion rolled his eyes.
If the Starks feel the need for gold, they can melt down Jaime's armor.
If we ask for truce, they will think us weak, Sir Adam argued. We should march on them at once.
Surely our friends at court could be prevailed upon to join us with fresh troops, said Sir Harry's, and someone might return to Castle Rock to raise a new host.
Lord Tywin Lannister rose to his feet.
They have my son,
he said once more, in a voice that cut through the babble like a sword through suet.
Leave me, all of you.
Ever the soul of obedience, Tyrion rose to depart with the rest. But his father gave him a look.
Not you, Tyrion, remain. And you as well, Kevin. The rest of you, out.
Tyrion eased himself back onto the bench, startled into speechlessness. Sir Kevin crossed the room to the wine cask.
Uncle, Tyrion called, if you would be so kind.
Here. His father offered him his cup, the wine untouched. Now Tyrion truly was nonplussed. He drank. Lord Tywin seated himself.
You have the right of it about Stark. Alive, we might have used Lord Eddard to forge a peace with Winterfell and Riverrun. A peace that would have given us the time we need to deal with Robert's brothers.
Dead? His hand curled into a fist.
Madness. Rank madness.
Joff's only a boy, Tyrion pointed out. At his age, I committed a few follies of my own.
His father gave him a sharp look.
I suppose we ought to be grateful that he has not yet married a whore.
Tyrion sipped at his wine, wondering how Lord Tywin would look if he flung the cup in his face.
Our position is worse than you know, his father went on. It would seem we have a new king.
Sir Kevin looked perplexed.
A new who? What have they done to Joffrey?
The faintest flicker of distaste played across Lord Tywin's thin lips.
Nothing yet. My grandson still sits the Iron Throne, but the eunuch has heard whispers from the south. Renly Baratheon wed Margaery Tyrell at Highgarden this fortnight past, and now he has claimed the crown. The bride's father and brothers have bent the knee and sworn him their swords.
Those are grave tidings. When Sir Kevin frowned, the furrows in his brow grew deep as canyons.
My daughter commands us to ride for King's Landing at once, to defend the Red Keep against King Renly and the Knight of Flowers.
His mouth tightened.
Commands us, mind you, in the name of the King and Council.
How is King Joffrey taking the news?
Tyrion asked, with a certain black amusement.
Cersei has not seen fit to tell him yet, Lord Tywin said. She fears he might insist on marching against Renly himself.
With what army?
Tyrion asked.
You don't plan to give him this one, I hope.
He talks of leading the city watch,
Lord Tywin said. If he takes the watch, he'll leave the city undefended, Sir Kevin said, and with Lord Stannis on Dragonstone.
Yes,
Lord Tywin looked down at his son.
I had thought you were the one made for Muttley, Tyrion, but it would appear that I was wrong.
Why, father, said Tyrion, that almost sounds like praise.
He leaned forward intently.
What of Stannis? He's the elder, not Renly. How does he feel about his brother's claim?
His father frowned.
I felt from the beginning that Stannis was a greater danger than all the others combined. Yet he does nothing. Oh, Varys hears his whispers. Stannis is building ships. Stannis is hiring sellswords. Stannis is bringing a shadowbinder from Ashai. What does it mean? Is any of it true?
He gave an irritated shrug.
"Kevin, bring us the map."
Sir Kevin did as he was bid. Lord Tywin unrolled the leather, smoothing it flat.
"Jaime has left us in a bad way. Roose Bolton and the remnants of his host are north of us. Our enemies hold the Twins and Moat Cailin. Robb Stark sits to the west, so we cannot retreat to Lannisport and the Rock unless we choose to give battle. Jaime is taken, and his army, for all purposes, has ceased to exist. Thoros of Myr and Beric Dondarrion continue to plague our foraging parties. To the east, we have the Aerons. Stannis Baratheon sits on Dragonstone, and in the south, Highgarden and Storm's End are calling their banners.
Tyrion smiled crookedly. Take heart, father. At least Rhaegar Targaryen is still dead.
I had to hoped you might have more to offer us than japes, Tyrion,
Lord Tywin Lannister said. Sir Kevin frowned over the map, forehead creasing. Robb Stark will have Edmure Tully and the Lords of the Trident with him now. Their combined power may exceed our own. And with Roose Bolton behind us... Tywin, if we remain here, I fear we might be caught between three armies.
I have no intention of remaining here. We must finish our business with young Lord Stark before Renly Baratheon can march from Highgarden. Bolton does not concern me. He's a wary man, and we made him warier on the Green Fork. He will be slow to give pursuit. So, on the morrow we make for Harrenhal. Kevin, I want Sir Adam's outriders to screen our movements. Give him as many men as he requires, and send them out in groups of four. I will have no vanishings.
As you say, my lord, but why Harrenhal?
That is a grim, unlucky place. Some call it cursed. Let them,
Lord Tywin said.
Unleash Sir Gregor and send him before us with his reavers. Send forth Vargo Holt and his free riders as well, and Sir Aemery Lorch. Each is to have 300 horse. Tell them I want to see the river rands of fire from the Guard's Eye to the Red Fork.
They will burn, my lord, Sir Kevin said, rising. I shall give the commands. He bowed and made for the door. When they were alone, Lord Tywin glanced at Tyrion.
Your savages might relish a bit of rapine. Tell them they may ride with Vargo Holt and plunder as they like. Good stock, women. They may take what they want and burn the rest.
Telling a shagger and timid how to pillage is like telling a rooster how to crow,
Tyrion commented.
But I should prefer to keep them with me.
Uncouth and unruly they might be, yet the wildlings were his, and he trusted them more than any of his father's men. He was not about to hand them over.
Then you had better learn to control them. I will not have the city plundered.
The city?
Tyrion was lost.
What city would that be?
King's Landing. I am sending you to court.
It was the last thing Tyrion Lannister would ever have anticipated. He reached for his wine and considered for a moment as he sipped.
And what am I to do there?
Rule,
his father said curtly. Tyrion hooted with laughter.
My sweet sister might have a word or two to say about that.
Let her say what she likes. Her son needs to be taken in hand before he ruins us all. I blame those jackanapes on the council, our friend Pataya, the venerable Grand Maester, and that cockless wonder, Lord Varys. What sort of counsel are they giving Joffrey when he lurches from one folly to the next? Whose notion was it to make this Janus Slint a lord? Huh? The man's father was a butcher, and they grant him Harrenhal? Harrenhal, that was the seat of kings. Not that he will ever set foot inside it, if I have any say. I'm told he took a bloody spear for his sigil. A bloody cleaver would have been my choice.
His father had not raised his voice, yet Tyrion could see the anger in the gold of his eyes.
"And dismissing Selmy? Where was the sense in that?" "Yes, the man was old, but the name of Barristan the Bold still has meaning in the realm. He lent honour to any man he served. Can anyone say the same of the Hound? You feed your dog bones under the table. You do not seat him beside you on the eye bench."
He pointed a finger at Tyrion's face.
"If Cersei cannot curb the boy, you must. And if these counsellors are playing us false..."
Tyrion knew.
"Spikes," he sighed. "Heads, walls."
"I see that you've taken a few lessons from me."
"More than you know, father,"
Tyrion answered quietly. He finished his wine and set the cup aside, thoughtful. A part of him was more pleased than he cared to admit. Another part was remembering the battle upriver, and wondering if he was being sent to hold the left again.
"Why me?" he asked, cocking his head to one side. "Why not my uncle? Why not Sir Adam, or Sir Flemont, or Lord Serret? Why not a bigger man?"
Lord Tywin rose abruptly. "You are my son."
That was when he knew.
"You have given him up for lost," he thought. "You bloody bastard. You think Jaime is good as dead. So I am all you have left."
Tyrion wanted to slap him, to spit in his face, to draw his dagger and cut the heart out of him, and see if it was made of old hard gold, the way the small folk said. Yet he sat there, silent and still. The shards of the broken cup crunched beneath his father's heels as Lord Tywin crossed the room.
"One last thing,"
he said at the door.
"You will not take the whore to court."
Tyrion sat alone in the common room for a long while after his father was gone. Finally, he climbed the steps to his cozy garret beneath the bell tower. The ceiling was low, but that was scarcely a drawback for a dwarf. From the window, he could see the gibbet his father had erected in the yard. The innkeep's body turned slowly on its rope whenever the night wind gusted. Her flesh had grown as thin and ragged as Lannister hopes. She murmured sleepily and rolled toward him when he sat on the edge of the feather bed. He slid his hand under the blanket and cupped a soft breast, and her eyes opened.
"My lord,"
she said with a drowsy smile. When he felt her nipple stiffen, Tyrion kissed her.
"I have a mind to take you to King's Landing, sweetling," he whispered.
John. The mare whickered softly as Jon Snow tightened the cinch.
"Easy, sweet lady,"
he said in a soft voice, quieting her with a touch. Wind whispered through the stable, a cold, dead breath on his face. But John paid it no mind. He strapped his roll to the saddle, his scarred fingers stiff and clumsy.
"Ghost," he called softly, "to me."
And the wolf was there, eyes like embers.
"John, please, you must not do this."
He mounted, the reins in his hand, and wheeled the horse round to face the night. Samwell Tarley stood in the stable door, a full moon peering over his shoulder. He threw a giant shadow, immense and black. "Get out of my way, Sam."
"John, you can't," Sam said. "I won't let you."
"I would sooner not hurt you," John told him. "Move aside, Sam, or I'll ride you down."
"You won't. You have to listen to me, please."
John put his spurs to horse flesh, and the mare bolted for the door. For an instant, Sam stood his ground, his face as round and pale as the moon behind him, his mouth a widening O of surprise. At the last moment, when they were almost on him, he jumped aside, as John had known he would, stumbled and fell. The mare leapt over him, out into the night. John raised the hood of his heavy cloak and gave the horse her head. Castle Black was silent and still as he rode out, with Ghost racing at his side. Men watched from the wall behind him, he knew, but their eyes were turned north, not south. No one would see him go. No one but Sam Tarley, struggling back to his feet in the dust of the old stables. He hoped Sam hadn't hurt himself, falling like that. He was so heavy and so ungainly, it would be just like him to break a wrist or twist his ankle getting out of the way.
"I warned him," John said aloud. "It was nothing to do with him, anyway."
He flexed his burned hand as he rode, opening and closing the scarred fingers. They still pained him, but it felt good to have the wrappings off. Moonlight silvered the hills as he followed the twisting ribbon of the King's Road. He needed to get as far from the wall as he could before they realized he was gone. On the morrow he would leave the road and strike out overland, through field and bush and stream, to throw off pursuit, but for the moment speed was more important than deception. It was not as though they would not guess where he was going. The old bear was accustomed to rise at first light, so John had until dawn to put as many leagues as he could between himself and the wall. If Sam Tarley did not betray him. The fat boy was dutiful and easily frightened, but he loved John like a brother. If questioned, Sam would doubtless tell them the truth, but John could not imagine him braving the guards in front of the King's Tower to wake Mormont from sleep. When John did not appear to fetch the old bear's breakfast from the kitchen, they'd look in his cell and find Longclaw on the bed. Been hard to abandon it, but John was not so lost to honour as to take it with him. Even Jorah Mormont had not done that when he fled in disgrace. Doubtless Lord Mormont would find someone more worthy of the blade. John felt bad when he thought of the old man. He knew his desertion would be salt in the still raw wound of his son's disgrace. That seemed a poor way to repay him for his trust, but it couldn't be helped. No matter what he did, John felt as though he were betraying someone. Even now he did not know if he was doing the honourable thing. The Southern had it easier. They had their septons to talk to, someone to tell them the gods will, and help sort out right from wrong. But the Starks worshipped the old gods, the nameless gods, and if the Heart Trees heard, they did not speak. When the last lights of Castle Black vanished behind him, John slowed his mare to a walk. He had a long journey ahead, and only the one horse to see him through. There were holdfasts and farming villages along the road south, where he might be able to trade the mare for a fresh mount when he needed one, but not if she were injured or blown. He would need to find new clothes soon. Most like he'd need to steal them. He was clad in black from head to heel. High leather riding boots, rough-spun breeches and tunic, sleeveless leather jerkin, and heavy wool cloak. His long sword and dagger were sheathed in black moleskin, and his hauberk and coif in his saddlebag were black ringmail. Any bit of it could mean his death if he were taken. A stranger wearing black was viewed with cold suspicion in every village and holdfast north of the Neck, and men would soon be watching for him. Once Maester Aemon's ravens took flight, John knew he would find no safe haven, not even at Winterfell. Bran might want to let him in, but Maester Lewin had better sense. He would bar the gates and send John away, as he should. Better not to call there at all. Yet he saw the castle clear in his mind's eye, as if he had left it only yesterday, the towering granite walls, the great hall, with its smells of smoke and dog and roasting meat, his father Solar, the turret room where he had slept. Part of him wanted nothing so much as to hear Bran laugh again, to sup on one of Gage's beef and bacon pies, to listen to old Nan tell her tales of the children of the forest and Florian the Fool. But he had not left the wall for that. He had left because he was, after all, his father's son and Rob's brother. The gift of a sword, even a sword as fine as Longclaw, did not make him a Mormont. Nor was he Aemon Targaryen. Three times the old man had chosen, and three times he had chosen honour. But that was him. Even now, John could not decide whether the maester had stayed because he was weak and craven, or because he was strong and true. Yet he understood what the old man had meant about the pain of choosing. He understood that all too well. Tyrion Lannister had claimed that most men would rather deny a hard truth than face it. But John was done with denials. He was who he was. John Snow. Bastard. An oathbreaker. Motherless, friendless, and damned. For the rest of his life, however long that might be, he would be condemned to be an outsider, the silent man standing in the shadows who dares not speak his true name. Wherever he might go throughout the Seven Kingdoms, he would need to live a lie, lest every man's hand be raised against him. But it made no matter. So long as he lived long enough to take his place by his brother's side and help avenge his father. He remembered Rob as he had last seen him, standing in the yard with snow melting in his auburn hair. John would have to come to him in secret, disguised. He tried to imagine the look on Rob's face when he revealed himself. His brother would shake his head and smile, and he'd say... He could not see the smile. Hard as he tried, he could not see it. He found himself thinking of the deserter his father had beheaded the day they found the direwolves. "You said the words," Lord Eddard had told him. "You took the vow before your brothers, before the old gods and the new." Desmond and Fat Tom had dragged the man to the stump. Bran's eyes had been wide as saucers, and John had to remind him to keep his pony in hand. He remembered the look on Father's face when Theon Greyjoy brought forth ice, the spray of blood on the snow, the way Theon had kicked the head when it came rolling at his feet. He wondered what Lord Eddard might have done if the deserter had been his brother Benjen instead of that ragged stranger. Would it have been any different? It must. Surely. Surely. And Rob would welcome him, for a certainty. He had to. Or else. It did not bear thinking about. Pain throbbed deep in his fingers as he clutched the reins. John put his heels into his horse and broke into a gallop, racing down the King's Road, as if to outrun his doubts. John was not afraid of death. But he did not want to die like that, trussed and bound and beheaded like a common brigand. If he must perish, let it be with a sword in his hand, fighting his father's killers. He was no true Stark, had never been one, but he could die like one. Let them say that Eddard Stark had fathered four sons, not three. Ghost kept pace with them for almost half a mile, red tongue lulling from his mouth. Man and horse alike lowered their heads as he asked the mare for more speed. The wolf slowed, stopped, watching, his eyes glowing red in the moonlight. He vanished behind, but John knew he would follow, at his own pace. Scattered lights flickered through the trees ahead of him, on both sides of the road. Mole's Town. A dog barked as he rode through, and he heard a mule's raucous hawk from the stable. But otherwise, the village was still. Here and there, the glow of hearth fires shone through shuttered windows, leaking between wooden slats, but only a few. Molestown was bigger than it seemed, but three-quarters of it was under the ground, in deep, warm cellars connected by a maze of tunnels. Even the whorehouse was down there. Nothing on the surface, but a wooden shack no bigger than a privy, with a red lantern hung above the door. On the wall he'd heard men call the whores buried treasures. He wondered whether any of his brothers in black were down there tonight, mining. That was oath-breaking, too, yet no one seemed to care. Not until he was well beyond the village did John slow again. By then both he and the mare were damp with sweat. He dismounted, shivering, his burned hand aching. A bank of melting snow lay under the trees, bright in the moonlight, water trickling off to form small, shallow pools. John squatted and brought his hands together, cupping the runoff between his fingers. The snow melt was icy cold. He drank and splashed some on his face until his cheeks tingled. His fingers were throbbing worse than they had in days, and his head was pounding too. "I am doing the right thing," he told himself, "so why do I feel so bad?" The horse was well lathered, so John took the lead and walked her for a while. The road was scarcely wide enough for two riders to pass abreast, its surface cut by tiny streams and littered with stone. That run had been truly stupid, an invitation to a broken neck. John wondered what had gotten into him. Was he in such a great rush to die? Off in the trees, the distant scream of some frightened animal made him look up. His mare whinnied nervously. Had his wolf found some prey? He cupped his hands around his mouth. "Ghost!" he shouted. "Ghost! To me!" The only answer was a rush of wings behind him as an owl took flight. Frowning, John continued on his way. He led the mare for half an hour until she was dry. Ghost did not appear. John wanted to mount up and ride again, but he was concerned about his missing wolf. "Ghost!" he called again. "Where are you? To me! Ghost!" Nothing in these woods could trouble a direwolf, even a half-grown direwolf, unless... No. Ghost was too smart to attack a bear, and if there was a wolf pack anywhere close, John would have surely heard them howling. He should eat, he decided. Food would settle his stomach and give Ghost a chance to catch up. There was no danger yet. Castle Black still slept. In his saddlebag he found a biscuit, a piece of cheese, a small withered brown apple. He'd brought salt beef as well, and a rasher of bacon he'd filched from the kitchens, but he would save the meat for the morrow. After it was gone, he'd need to hunt, and that would slow him. John sat under the trees and ate his biscuit and cheese while his mare grazed along the King's Road. He kept the apple for last. It had gone a little soft, but the flesh was still tart and juicy. He was down to the core when he heard the sounds. Horses. And from the north. Quickly, John leapt up and strode to his mare. Could he outrun them? No, they were too close. They'd hear him for a certainty. And if they were from Castle Black... He led the mare off the road behind a thick stand of grey-green sentinels. "Quiet now," he said in a hushed voice, crouching down to peer through the branches. If the guards were kind, the riders would pass by. Likely as not, they were only small folk from Molestown, farmers on their way to the fields, although what they were doing out in the middle of the night... He listened to the sound of hooves growing steadily louder as they trotted briskly down the King's Road. From the sound, there were five or six of them, at the least. Their voices drifted through the trees. "Certainly came this way." "We can't be certain. He could have ridden east, for all you know, or left the road to cut through the woods. That's what I'd do. In the dark, stupid. If you didn't fall off your horse and break your neck, you'd get lost and wind up back at the wall. When the sun came up, I would not." Gren sounded peeved. "I'd just ride south. You can tell south by the stars." "What if the sky was cloudy?" Pip asked. "Well, then I wouldn't go." Another voice broke in. "You know where I'd be, if it was me. I'd be in Molestown, digging for buried treasure." Toad's shrill laughter boomed through the trees. John's mare snorted. "Keep quiet, all of you," Alder said. "I thought I heard something." "Where? I didn't hear anything." The horses stopped. "You can't hear yourself far." "I can too," Gren insisted. "Quiet." They all fell silent, listening. John found himself holding his breath. Sam, he thought. He hadn't gone to the old bear, but he hadn't gone to bed either. He'd woken the other boys. Damn them all. Come dawn, if they were not in their beds, they'd be named deserters too. What did they think they were doing? The hushed silence seemed to stretch on and on. From where John crouched, he could see the legs of their horses through the branches. Finally, Pip spoke up.
What did you hear?
I don't know, Holder admitted. A sound, I thought. It might have been a horse, but...
There's nothing here.
Out of the corner of his eye, John glimpsed a pale shape moving through the trees. Leaves rustled, and ghosts came bounding out of the shadows, so suddenly that John's mare started and gave a whinny.
There! Holder shouted.
I heard it too.
Traitor,
John told the direwolf as he swung up into the saddle. He turned the mare's head to slide off through the trees, but they were on him before he had gone 10 feet.
John!
Pip shouted after him.
Pull up! Gren said. You can't outrun us all.
John wheeled around to face them, drawing his sword.
Get back. I don't wish to hurt you, but I will if I have to.
One against seven,
Holder gave the signal. The boys spread out, surrounding him.
What do you want with me? John demanded. We want to take you back where you belong, Pip said.
I belong with my brother.
Where are your brothers now? Gren said. They'll cut off your head, if they catch you, you know, Tud put in with a nervous laugh. This is so stupid, it's like something the Oryx would do.
I would not, Gren said. I'm no oath-breaker. I said the words and I meant them.
So did I, John told them. Don't you understand? They murdered my father. It's war. My brother Rob is fighting in the Riverlands.
We know, Pip said solemnly. Sam told us everything.
We're sorry about your father, Gren said. But it doesn't matter. Once you say the words, you can't leave, no matter what.
I have to, John said fervently.
You said the words, Pip reminded him. Now my watch begins. You said it. It shall not end until my death.
I shall live and die at my post, Gren said, nodding.
You don't have to tell me the words. I know them as well as you do.
He was angry now. Why couldn't they let him go in peace? They were only making it harder.
I am the sword in the darkness,
Holder intoned.
The watcher on the walls, piped Toad.
John cursed them all to their faces. They took no notice. Pip spurred his horse closer, reciting,
I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men.
Stay back, John warned him, brandishing his sword. I mean it, Pip. They weren't even wearing armor. He could cut them to pieces if he had to. Mathar had circled behind him. He joined the chorus.
I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch.
John kicked his mare, spinning her in a circle. The boys were all around him now, closing from every side.
For this night, Holder trotted in from the left, and all the nights to come.
Finished Pip. He reached over for John's reins.
So air your choices. Kill me, or come back with me.
John lifted his sword and lowered it helpless.
Damn you, he said. Damn you all.
Do we have to bind your hands, or will you give us your word you will ride back peaceful? Asked Holder.
I won't run, if that's what you mean. Ghost moved out from under the trees, and John glared at him.
Small help you were, he said.
The deep red eyes looked at him knowingly.
We'd best hurry, Pip said. If we're not back before first light, the old bear will have all our heads.
On the ride back, John Snow remembered little. It seemed shorter than the journey south, perhaps because his mind was elsewhere. Pip set the pace, galloping, walking, trotting, and then breaking into another gallop. Millstown came and went, the red lantern over the brothel long extinguished. They made good time. Dawn was still an hour off when John glimpsed the towers of Castle Black ahead of them, dark against the pale immensity of the wall. It did not seem like home this time. They could take him back, John told himself, but they could not make him stay. The war would not end on the morrow or the day after, and his friends could not watch him day and night. He would bide his time, make them think he was content to remain here. And then, when they had grown lax, he would be off again. Next time, he would avoid the King's Road. He could follow the wall east, perhaps all the way to the sea. A longer route, but a safer one. Or even west, to the mountains, and then south, over the high passes. That was the wildling's way, hard and perilous, but at least no one would follow him. He wouldn't stray within 100 leagues of Winterfell, or the King's Road. Samuel Tarly awaited them in the old stables, slumped on the ground against a bale of hay, too anxious to sleep. He rose and brushed himself off.
I'm glad they found you, John.
I am not, John said, dismounting. Pip hopped off his horse and looked at the lightening sky with disgust.
Give us a hand bedding down the horses, Sam, the small boy said. We have a long day before us, and no sleep to face it on, thanks to Lord Snow.
When day broke, John walked to the kitchens, as he did every dawn. Three-finger Hub said nothing as he gave him the old bear's breakfast. Today it was 3 brown eggs boiled hard, with fried bread and ham steak, and a bowl of wrinkled plums. John carried the food back to the King's Tower. He found Mormont at the window seat, writing. His raven was walking back and forth across his shoulders, muttering, "Corn! Corn! Corn!" The bird shrieked when John entered. "Put the food on the table," the old bear said, glancing up. "I'll have some bear." John opened a shuttered window, took the flagon of beer off the outside ledge, and filled a horn. Hob had given him a lemon, still cold from the wall. John crushed it in his fist. The juice trickled through his fingers. Mormont drank lemon in his beer every day and claimed that was why he still had his own teeth. "Doubtless you loved your father," Mormont said, when John brought him his horn. "The things we love destroy us every time, lad. Remember when I told you that?"
"I remember," John said solemnly. He did not care to talk of his father's death, not even to Mormont.
"See that you never forget it. The hard truths are the ones to hold tight. Fetch me my plate. Is it ham again? So be it. You look weary. Was your moonlight ride so tiring?"
John's throat was dry.
"You know."
"No,"
the raven echoed from Mormont's shoulder.
"No."
The old bear snorted.
"Do you think they chose me Lord Commander of the Night's Watch because I'm dumb as a stump, Snow? Aemon told me you'd go. I told him you'd be back. I know my men, and my boys, too. Honor set you on the King's Road, and honor brought you back."
"My friends brought me back," John said.
"Did I say it was your honor?" Mormont inspected his plate.
"They killed my father. Did you expect me to do nothing?"
"If truth be told, we expect you to do just as you did."
Mormont tried a plum, spit out the pit.
"I ordered a watch kept over you. You were seen leaving. If your brothers had not fetched you back, you would have been taken along the way, and not by friends. Unless you have a horse with wings, like a raven. Do you?"
"No." John felt like a fool.
"Pity. We could use a horse like that."
John stood tall. He told himself that he would die well. That much he could do, at the least. "I know the penalty for desertion, my lord. I'm not afraid to die."
"Die,"
the raven cried.
"Nor live, I hope," Mormont said, cutting his ham with a dagger and feeding a bite to the bird. "You have not deserted. Yet, here you stand. If we beheaded every boy who rode to Mole's Town in the night, only ghosts would guard the wall. Yet maybe you mean to flee again on the morrow, or a fortnight from now. Is that it? Is that your hope, boy?"
John kept silent.
"I thought so." Mormont peeled the shell off a boiled egg. "Your father is dead, lad. Do you think you can bring him back?
No, he answered, sullen.
Good, Mormont said. We've seen the dead come back, you and me. It's not something I care to see again.
He ate the egg in two bites and flicked a bit of shell out from between his teeth.
Your brother is in the field with all the powers of the North behind him. Any one of his lord's bannermen commands more swords than you'll find in all the Night's Watch. Now why do you imagine they need your help, Are you such a mighty warrior? Or do you carry a grumpkin in your pocket to magic up your sword?
John had no answer for him. The raven was pecking at an egg, breaking the shell. Pushing his beak back through the hole, he pulled out morsels of white and yolk. The old bear sighed.
You are not the only one touched by this war. Like as not, my sister's marching in your brother's host, her and those daughters of hers, dressed in men's mail. Mage is a hoary old snark, stubborn, short-tempered and willful. Truth be told, I can hardly stand to be around the wretched woman. But that does not mean my love for her is any less than the love you bear your half-sisters.
Frowning, Mormont took his last egg and squeezed it in his fist until the shell crunched.
Or perhaps it does. Be that as it may, I still grieve if she was slain. Yet you don't see me running off. I said the words, just as you did. My place is here. Where is yours, boy?
I have no place, John wanted to say. I'm a bastard. I have no rights, no name, no mother. And now not even a father. The words would not come.
I don't know.
I do, said Lord Commander Mormont. The cold winds are rising, Snow. Beyond the wall, the shadows lengthen. Cutter Pike writes of vast herds of elk streaming south and east toward the sea, and mammoths as well. He says one of his men discovered huge, misshapen footprints not 3 leagues from East Watch. Rangers in the Shadow Tower have found whole villages abandoned. And at night, Sir Dennis says, they see fires in the mountains, huge blazes that burn from dusk to dawn. Quarin Halfhand took a captive in the depths of the gorge, and the man swears that Mance Rayder is massing all his people in some new secret stronghold he's found. To what end, the gods only know. Do you think your Uncle Benjen was the only ranger we've lost this past year?
Benjen!
The raven squawked, bobbing his head, bits of egg dribbling from his beak.
Benjen! Benjen!
No, John said. There had been others. Too many.
Do you think your brother's war is more important than ours?
The old man barked. John chewed his lip. The raven flapped its wings at him.
War! 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 War!
It sang.
It's not, Mormont told him. God save us, boy. You're not blind. You're not stupid. When dead men come hunting in the night, do you think it matters who sits the Iron Throne?
No. John had not thought of it that way.
Your Lord Father sent you to us, John. Why? Who can say? Why? Why? Why?
The raven called.
All I know is that the blood of the first men flows in the veins of the Starks. The first men built the wall, and it said they remember things otherwise forgotten. And that beast of yours, he led us to the Whites, warned you of the dead man on the steps. Sir Jeremy would doubtless call that happenstance, yet Sir Jeremy is dead, and I'm not.
Lord Mormont stabbed a chunk of ham with the point of his dagger.
I think you were meant to be here, and I want you and that wolf of yours with us when we go beyond the wall.
His words sent a chill of excitement down John's back. Beyond the wall?
You heard me. I mean to find Ben Stark, alive or dead.
He chewed and swallowed.
I will not sit here, meekly,
and wait for the snows and the ice winds. We must know what is happening. This time the Night's Watch will ride in force against the king beyond the wall, the others, or anything else that may be out there. I mean to command them myself.
He pointed his dagger at John's chest.
By custom, the Lord Commander Stuart is his squire as well. But I do not care to wake every morning wondering if you'd run off again. So I will have an answer from you, John Snow, and I will have it now. Are you a brother of the Night's Watch? Or only a bastard boy who wants to play at war?
John Snow straightened himself and took a long, deep breath.
Forgive me, Father, Rob, Arya, Bran. Forgive me. I cannot help you. He has the truth of it. This is my place.
I am yours, my lord. Your man. I swear it. I will not run again. Mael Bear snorted.
Good. Now, go put on your sword.
Catelyn. It seemed 1,000 years ago that Catelyn Stark had carried her infant son out of Riverrun, crossing the Tumblestone in a small boat to begin the journey north to Winterfell. And it was across the Tumblestone that they came home now, though the boy wore plate and mail in place of swaddling clothes. Rob sat in the bow with Greywind, his hand resting on his direwolf's head, as the rowers pulled at their oars. Theon Greyjoy was with him. Her uncle, Brynden, would come behind in the second boat, with the Great John and Lord Carstark. Catelyn took a place toward the stern. They shot down the Tumblestone, letting the strong current push them past the looming wheel tower. The splash and rumble of the great water wheel within was a sound from her girlhood that brought a sad smile to Catelyn's face. From the sandstone walls of the castle, soldiers and servants shouted down her name, and Rob's, and Winterfell. From every rampart waved the banner of House Tully, a leaping trout silver against a rippling blue and red field. It was a stirring sight, yet it did not lift her heart. She wondered if, indeed, her heart would ever lift again.
Oh, Ned.
Below the wheel tower, they made a wide turn and knifed through the churning water. The men put their backs into it. The wide arch of the water gate came into view, and she heard the creak of heavy chains as the great iron portcullis was winched upward. It rose slowly as they approached, and Catelyn saw that the lower half of it was red with rust. The bottom foot dripped brown mud on them as they passed underneath, the barbed spikes mere inches above their heads. Catelyn gazed up at the bars and wondered how deep the rust went, and how well the portcullis would stand up to a ram, and whether it ought to be replaced. Thoughts like that were seldom far from her mind these days. They passed beneath the arch and under the walls, moving from sunlight to shadow and back into sunlight. Boats large and small were tied up all around them, secured to iron rings set in the stone. Her father's guards waited on the water stair with her brother. Sir Edmure Tully was a stocky young man with a shaggy head of auburn hair and a fiery beard. His breastplate was scratched and dented from battle, his blue and red cloak stained by blood and smoke. At his side stood the Lord Titus Blackwood, a hard pike of a man, with close-cropped salt-and-pepper whiskers and a hooked nose. His bright yellow armour was inlaid with jet in elaborate vine and leaf patterns, and a cloak, sewn from raven's feathers, draped his thin shoulders. It had been Lord Titus that led the sortie that plucked her brother from the Lannister camp.
"Bring them in!"
Sir Edmure commanded. Three men scrambled down the stairs, knee-deep in the water, and pull the boat close with long hooks. When Grey Wind bounded out, one of them dropped his pole and lurched back, stumbling and sitting down abruptly in the water. The others laughed, and the man got a sheepish look on his face. Theon Greyjoy vaulted over the side of the boat and lifted Catelyn by the waist, setting her on a dry step above him as the water lapped around his boots. Edmure came down the steps to embrace her. "Sweet sister," he murmured hoarsely. He had deep blue eyes and a mouth made for smiles, but he was not smiling now. He looked worn and tired, battered by battle, and haggard from strain. His neck was bandaged where he had taken a wound. Catelyn hugged him fiercely.
"Your grief is mine, Cat," he said when they broke apart. "When we heard about Lord Eddard, the Lannisters will pay. I swear it. You will have your vengeance."
"Will that bring Ned back to me?" she said sharply. The wound was still too fresh for softer words. She could not think about Ned now. She would not. It would not do. She had to be strong. "All that will keep. I must see Father."
"He awaits you in Isola," Edmure said. "Lord Uster is bedridden, my lady,"
her father Stuart explained. When had this good man grown so old and grey?
"He instructed me to bring you to him at once."
"I'll take her." Edmure escorted her up the water stair and across the lower bailey, where Petar Baelish and Brandon Stark had once crossed swords for her favour. The massive sandstone walls of the keep loomed above them. As they pushed through a door, between two guardsmen in fish-crest helms, she asked, "How bad is he?" dreading the answer, even as she said the words. Edmure's look was somber.
"He will not be with us long, the maesters say. The pain is constant and grievous."
A blind rage filled her. A rage at all the world, at her brother Edmure and her sister Lysa, at the Lannisters, at the maesters, at Ned and her father and the monstrous gods who would take them both away from her. "You should have told me," she said. "You should have sent me word as soon as you knew."
"He forbade it. He did not want his enemies to know that he was dying. With the realm so troubled, he feared that if the Lannisters suspected how frail he was,
they might attack." Catelyn finished hard.
"It was your doing, yours," a voice whispered inside her. "If you had not taken it upon yourself to seize the dwarf..."
They climbed the spiral stair in silence. The keep was three-sided, like River Run itself, and Lord Huster Solar was triangular as well, with a stone balcony that jutted out to the east like the prow of some great sandstone ship. From there the lord of the castle could look down on his walls and battlements, and beyond to where the waters met. They had moved her father's bed out onto the balcony.
"He likes to sit in the sun and watch the rivers," Edmure explained. "Father, see who I've brought. Cat has come to see you."
Huster Tully had always been a big man, tall and broad in his youth, portly as he grew older. Now he seemed shrunken, the muscle and meat melted off his bones. Even his face sagged. The last time Catelyn had seen him, his hair and beard had been brown, well streaked with grey. Now they had gone white as snow. His eyes opened to the sound of Edmure's voice.
"Little cat,"
he murmured, in a voice thin and wispy and racked by pain.
"My little cat."
A tremulous smile touched his face as his hand groped for hers.
"I watched for you."
"I shall leave you to talk," her brother said, kissing their lord father gently on the brow before he withdrew. Catelyn knelt and took her father's hand in hers. It was a big hand, but fleshless now, the bones moving loosely under the skin, all the strength gone from it.
"You should have told me," she said. "A rider, a raven, Raiders are taken, questioned, he answered. Ravens are brought down.
A spasm of pain took him, and his fingers clutched hers hard.
The crabs are in my belly, pinching, always pinching, day and night. They have fierce claws, the crabs. Maester Wyman makes me dream wine, milk of the puppy. I sleep a lot, but I wanted to be awake to see you when you came. I was afraid. When the Lannisters took your brother, the camps all around us, I was afraid I would go before I could see you again. I was afraid.
I am here, father, she said, with Rob, my son. He'll want to see you too.
Your boy, he whispered. He had my eyes, I remember.
He did, and he does. And we brought you Jamie Lannister in irons. River Run is free again, father. Lord Huster smiled.
I saw. Last night, when it began, I told them. Had to see. They carried me to the gatehouse. Watched from the battlements. Ah, that was beautiful. The torches came in a wave. I could hear the cries floating across the river. Sweet cries. When that siege tower went up, gods would have died then, and glad. If only I could have seen you children first. Was it your boy who did it? Was it your Rob?
Yes, Catelyn said, fiercely proud. It was Rob. And Brynden. Your brother is here as well, my lord.
Him?
Her father's voice was a faint whisper.
The blackfish came back from the vale?
Yes.
And Lysa?
A cold wind moved through his thin white hair.
Gods be good. Your sister, did she come as well?
He sounded so full of hope and yearning that it was hard to tell the truth. No. I'm sorry.
Oh.
His face fell, and some light went out of his eyes.
I'd hoped I would have liked to see her before.
She's with her son, in the Eyrie. Lord Huster gave a weary nod.
Lord Robert, no. Poor Aaron's gone. I remember. Why did she not come with you?
She is frightened, my lord. In the Eyrie she feels safe. She kissed his wrinkled brow. Rob will be waiting. Will you see him? And Brynden?
Your son,
he whispered.
Yes, Cat's child. He had my eyes, I remember. When he was born. Bring him, yes.
And your brother? Her father glanced out over the rivers.
Blackfish, he said. Has he wed yet? Taken some girl to wife?
Even on his deathbed, Catelyn thought sadly. He has not wed. You know that, father. Nor will he ever.
I told him, commanded him, marry. I was his lord, he knows. My right to make his match. A good match. A red wine. Old house, sweet girl. Pretty. Freckles. Bethany, yes. Poor child. Still waiting. Yes. Still.
Bethany Redwine wed Lord Rowan years ago, Catelyn reminded him. She has three children by him.
Even so,
Lord Huster muttered.
Even so, spit on the girl, the Redwines. Spit on me? His lord, his brother, that Blackfish. I had other offers. Lord Brandon.